You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Beard, the protagonist of Ian McEwan's latest book, Solar, is an aging, overweight physicist who's been coasting on a Nobel Prize he won 30 years ago, giving speeches, lending his name to the letterheads of scientific societies, and chasing women. Beard is not above cheating on his wives and girlfriends or trying to get rich using an idea for turning solar energy into electricity through artificial photosynthesis that he has stolen from a young colleague. The novel is Ian McEwan's 14th. It's published by Doubleday's Nan A. Talese imprint, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hi.
Hi.
Michiko Kakutani called Solar your funniest novel yet in her March 30th review in the New York Times. And I've seen it described by others as a farce or a black comedy. Didn't you recently tell an audience that you hated comic novels and that reading them was like being wrestled to the ground and tickled?
I did. I'm not a great fan of comic novels that try to be funny at every turn. The kind of novel I like that has humor in it has, you know, those passages. I think novels should be a little more symphonic. They have slow movements, they speed up, the pulse changes. So I hope that Solar is not trying to wrestle you to the ground and force
but
it.
But you must have started off thinking that you were going to write a satire.
I started off thinking that climate change is one of the most intractable subjects for a novel. You know, impacted with politics, morality, statistics, physics. And for years was looking out of the corner of my eye for some way in. And I found myself up in the Arctic with a group of artists and scientists living on a boat frozen into a fjord. And we were having very passionate, idealistic discussions about climate change and how to live and how to be throughout the week. And just next door was our kit room, falling into greater and greater chaos. And I saw, as did my friends, something of the humor of the chaos of our immediate surroundings and lives and arrangements. And the passionate wish for order and sense and rationality in our ideals, and I thought, in there somewhere is at least a vein of humor that might take me into this subject.
And that provided, I was assume that trip, the inspiration for what became one of your novel's funniest parts, the story of the ship's boot room.
Exactly so. The boot room, the kit room, really was a sort of allegory for that problem we have between making grand resolutions. I mean, who can forget Rio, you know, back in the early 90s and many, many other conferences in which we make these promises to ourselves to get better, to behave, or, as it were, in the private life, to lose weight, to eat better, to take more exercise, and then life rolls on, and we don't quite make it.
And so the boot room, where people's boots seem to disappear, turns honest, well-meaning travelers into petty thieves and liars.
Yes. I mean, petty thieves is putting it a little too strongly. All the kit in our boot room was lent to us by, you know, the organizers of the trip. And, you know, the helmet that you put one place, not there the next day, so you take another, and it's really about how well-meaning people can, in fact, create great misery around them.
Although, in the case of Michael Beard, who is a thief and a liar, he's not a well-meaning person.
Well,
at least he's become a not a well-meaning person.
He creates chaos wherever he goes. He's a liar, a thief, a fat man who just gets fatter and fatter through the book, can't resist stuffing his face with everything that comes his way.
The review in Time magazine begins by pointing out that the past few months have been difficult for climate scientists, but that when word went out that your new novel would be about climate change, the scientists hoped, in the light of your understanding of the world of science, that they had found a champion.
Well, I think a novel dies on its feet when you try to stuff a moral down people's throats. I have my own strong ideas about climate science and global warming, but I thought the best way into this subject for me was through human nature. Our own natures really do stand in our way. So I heaped onto Michael Beard many, many of our faults.
So, and you seem to be suggesting that this is too difficult a problem for our generation to solve, that we're just not big-spirited and generous enough to seriously tackle it?
Well, I think one of the problems we have is our nature allows us an extraordinary degree of cleverness. I mean, we do invent things, we make things, we astound ourselves with what we can achieve with our rationality. And we saw it at Copenhagen, the world's scientists summoned, as it were, 192 nations to one place. And it seemed as if our cleverness was going to triumph. But what happens? Another side of our nature gets in the way. Little cabals spring up, self-interest in the form of national self-interest gets in the way, and the whole thing disintegrates in tears.
It's not just global warming. We saw the same thing with Rwanda. We've seen it with any number of crises throughout the world where all sorts of other, or in Sudan right now.
Constantly, our cleverness to, our ability to analyze a situation shows us the full tragedy of it, but other elements get in the way. Greed, stupidity, tribalism of one sort or another.
When the book opens, Michael Beard is the head of a government research center that studies global warming, yet he's somewhat cynical about the issue of climate change. He finds his colleagues who are passionate about the problem somewhat tiresome.
Yes, he's in that middle ground. He thinks it's a problem, but just one of many. He's not really involved in it. He knows that, yes, carbon dioxide is going to warm the planet if you put too much of it in the air, but there are many other things to think about, and he's a little skeptical about the language used. It's got a sort of millennial quality that he distrusts. And the novel is in part the story of the journey of Michael Beard to come in possession of what he thinks is the one thing that will transform the situation, make him rich and famous, and in fact it's stolen, as you said in your introduction, from another man.
But at the beginning, and I don't want to go into all of the details, because this book does have a complex second half. I will say that everything is resolved in the second half, and I wondered whether that was important to you.
Well, what happens in the second half, and I don't want to give much away either. I mean, the book's in three parts, but by the time everybody in the novel gets to the deserts of New Mexico, the chaos of Michael Beard's life and all his lies and deceptions all come flooding home to roost. I mean, the sky gets dark with chickens flying back to, as it were, confront the hero. And I really leave this novel up in the air in a sense of where we more or less are now, post-Copenhagen. A lot of public trust has bled away. A lot of public trust in scientists as well as politicians has had a huge knock. And that's why, right in the final draft of this novel, I decided to invite Michael Beard to Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. The novel ends just a few months before Copenhagen begins, and I thought he would be just the man for the job.
You are going to read a little bit for us. Should I set it up? I mean, you should set it up. I will say that at the beginning of the novel, when I said he's working, he's bored by his colleagues, he seems to be more interested in thinking about his fifth wife, Patrice, who seems ready to leave him with good cause.
Yes, he's a philanderer, but he starts the novel with the roles reversed. He is the cuckold. She is having the affair.
But he's been having affairs all along.
Exactly.
Anyway, this is a double standard.
This is a double standard, and he knows full well it is, but it doesn't stop him feeling profoundly disturbed and humiliated, and suddenly he understands what it's like. But I'll read you a little bit about his appetites, because I think it resonates for all of us in the West, we who live relatively well. So he's just been to buy a bit of junk food. It was a plastic foil bag of finely sliced potatoes, boiled in oil and dusted in salt, industrialized powdered foodstuffs, preservatives, enhancers, hydrolyzing and raising agents, acidity regulators, and coloring. Salt and vinegar-flavored chips. He was still stuffed from his lunch, but this particular chemical feast could not be found in Paris, Berlin, or Tokyo. And he longed for it now, the actinic sting of these 30 grams, a drug dealer's measure. One last jolt to the system, and then he would never touch the junk again. He thought there was every chance of resisting until he was on the Paddington train. He stuffed the bag into the pocket of his jacket, took up his burden of papers and wheeled luggage and continued across the concourse. He was 35 pounds overweight. About his future lightness, he had made many general resolutions and virtuous promises, often after dinner with a glass in his hand. And what defeated him always was the present, the moment of vivid confrontation with the affirming tidbit, the extra course, the meal he did not really need when the short-term faction carried the day. And the flight from Berlin was a typical failure. At the start, as he lowered his broad rear into his seat barely 2 hours after a meaty Germanic breakfast, he was forming his resolutions. No drinks but water, no snacks, a green leaf salad, a portion of fish, no pudding. And at the same time, at the approach of a silver tray and the murmured invitation of a female voice, his hand was closing round the stem of his runway champagne. A half hour later, he was ripping open the sachet of a salt-studded beef-glazed toasted corn-type sticklet snack that came with his jumbo gin and tonic. Then there was spread before him a white tablecloth, the sight of which fired some neuronal starter gun for his stomach juices. The gin melted his remaining resolve. He chose the starter he had decided against, quail's legs wrapped in bacon on a bed of creamed garlic, then cubes of pork belly mounted on a hill fort of buttered rice. The word pavé was another one of those starter guns, a paving slab of chocolate sponge encased in chocolate under a chocolate sauce, goat's cheese, cow's cheese in a nest of white grapes, three rolls, a chocolate mint, three glasses of burgundy, and finally, as though it would absolve him of all else, he forced himself back through the menu to confront the oil-sodden salad that came with the quail. When his tray was removed, only the grapes remained.
Ian McEwan reading from his latest novel, Solar, making me a little hungry, actually. That sounds pretty good. He is the author, of course, of the novels on Chesil Beach, Saturday Atonement, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, The Comfort of Strangers, made into one of the scariest movies, Black Dogs, Amsterdam, which won the Booker Prize, The Child in Time, winner of the Whitbread Award, also author of a number of short story collections, First Love, Last Rites, and In Between the Sheets. This book is published by Nanny Talese at Doubleday. Beard has won the Nobel Prize for a theory called the Beard-Einstein conflation he developed when he was a postgraduate student. Is this based on real science, or can a writer of fiction take scientific liberties?
It's a bit of a liberty. Einstein won his Nobel Prize for what we know as photovoltaics, the way when a photon strikes a semiconductor, it produces an electron to move away and create electricity. And Beard wins his prize for work he did at the age of 23 or 4, modifying Einstein's photovoltaics. Now, to be quite honest, I didn't really know quite how he'd modified it, but I found a very friendly physicist at Cambridge University in England, who's a mathematician as well as a physicist, and got him to reverse engineer. So when I finished the novel, I gave it to him and said, can you work out exactly what science he might have done, and could you write the Nobel citation for his award? So he came up with some work that involved Richard Feynman, you know, another real great American physicist, and had fun. He was a physicist who loved a bit of intellectual mischief, and so I really had to have help there.
Well, you've written a number of novels in which science has played a major role. Enduring Love included Information on Evolutionary Biology. Saturday focused on neurosurgery. Have you always been interested in science?
Yes, I have. I mean, I sometimes think it's not science I'm interested in, but the world that science describes. You know, I think if I could put it down to anything, it's simply intellectual curiosity about how the world is and how our views of it change and refine themselves. And over the years, I've come to love the company of scientists. I've seen a few here in New York. I like their conversation. I love their optimism. Very different from, you know, us humanists and our sort of automatic pessimism about the way things are.
Because they think they're going to work it out as soon as they figure out that equation, get it just right.
They love a problem, and it makes them good to sort of address it.
Well, what are your thoughts on C.P. Snow's notion of two cultures?
I think it's still with us to to some degree. I think it's eroded because science has become so much part of our lives. I mean, we all own a laptop. We all worry about GM crops, and climate science, of course, has invaded our thoughts. But still, I think our education system splits. And, you know, I think that many of us who are humanists, liberal arts people, have missed out on some of the pleasures. I think we could have science without having to be scientists.
But you also suggest that scientists are optimistic and that humanists are pessimistic. The scientists were working out problems. Aren't you, as a novelist, working out problems?
I think I'm reflecting problems. I don't think I've...
Well, you got a book, and the book is a big lump. It's a big mess, and you say, gee, I'm going to have to figure out a way to get this thing to work.
To shape the novel, yes, but to solve the problems and tell people how to live through them, no. I think what I have to do in the novel is reflect our natures, reflect what we're up against in this particular problem, give some parallel to ourselves in a distorting mirror through this fellow Michael Beard.
How much... well, you've been said that... you've been quoted as saying that most novels are boring, that they are too intellectually timid. Is including substantive information about science in your novels a way of making sure they're never boring?
I've lived to regret that remark. I think I must have been in a bar and I had just waded through, I don't know, five or six bound proofs of, and not been interested. Now, I've read plenty of fine, good contemporary novels. But I think sometimes writers do maybe play down their own intellectual muscle, spend too long in the emotions. Of course we need the world of emotions animated for us. But also, I tell you what it is, too many novels written in the first person. It's almost like an apology is to say, well, you know, I can only give you this little thing. Rather than doing what the 19th century novelists do, sort of say, I can be godly, I can describe the world, I'll give you my best image on this. Too much hiding behind a character who will make excuses for all your cliches. You know, every cliche you have, every bad image, you can say, well, that's just the character of my hero talking.
But Michael Beard is a guy who rationalizes everything. I'm reminded of another Nobel Prize winner, John Updike's Beck, who kills a critic and then wins the Nobel Prize.
Kills more than one critic, as I remember, brilliantly, and goes up on stage with his granddaughter in his arms and gives her the last word. I think one of the finest moments in post-war American literature.
You, the passage that you quoted about him eating the bag of potato chips... it seemed to me also to be poking fun at the allegation that you'd taken the story about potato chips from Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series. You were kind of poking fun at your people who read books and look for all of the chinks in the armor of the author.
Yes, there's a little episode on the train that Michael Beard takes his chips there, and there's a little drama with another passenger. And someone once said to me, oh, well, that's in a Douglas Adams novel. But I knew, actually, it was an urban legend. It's one of those stories that we love to hear and we love to believe true. And often people will tell you these stories as happening to a friend of theirs or happening to themselves. And they go around rather like dirty jokes go around. They change, they move. And in fact...
But they satisfy certain needs.
They do. It's very
powerful. Confirm a belief.
Yeah, and... fortunately, now we have the internet. You can go on these urban legend sites, and all those stories about alligators in the New York sewers or whatever it is, they turn out to be apocryphal. And we love them. We need them. We hug them to ourselves.
So what's next? More short stories, or is there another novel in the works?
At the moment, I'm writing a screenplay of On Chesil Beach, my last novel. And I hope Sam Mendes will direct it. So I've been in New York chatting with him about how to proceed. I'm about two-thirds of the way through and actually having a lot more fun than I thought. There's very little dialogue in that novel, so I've had to sort sort of bring them to life, these two characters.
A lot of writers don't like to adapt their own novels to film because they don't want to sacrifice things, and also because they're ultimately disappointed with the way thing turns out. It's so much easier to just simply say, I'll take the money, let somebody else write it, and whatever comes out, comes out. Although, in your case, there have been some good films and some less good films.
I mean, generally, that's been my view, not to do your own stuff. I did The Innocent with John Schlesinger years ago, and it didn't work out very well. Why this time? Because it's a novella, because I knew I'd finish Solar and it'd be a lovely thing to do between novels, and also because I guess I didn't want someone else to do it for once. I thought, I'm the only one who can do this.
Solar is published by Doubleday, the Nan A. Talese imprint, and my great thanks to Ian McEwan for being my guest again today.
It's been a great pleasure.